the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. This is Ray Nothstein, and sitting in today for Brooke Medina is Leah Byers. Brooke is on vacation. I saw her in Atlanta, then I saw her voting up here in Wake County, then I saw she texted me from Fayetteville. I think she was in the office the other day. So she's been all over the place. But today we have Leah Byers, and we're going to have a great discussion. The first thing we're going to look at is Halloween in the fall. And then just briefly touch on the Hong Kong protests and how that relates to NBA and corporatism in America and the latest news on Medicaid expansion in North Carolina. Leah's going to take the lead on that, and we'll look at some election 2020 news in North Carolina and the state. Leah, how's it going today?
It's going good. I'm so happy to be on Civitalk.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You're going to have some great stories, I think, for us today. And just, I think, give some insight that we don't normally get from somebody who studies this policy full-time, and especially on Medicaid expansion, because that's such an interesting topic and obviously been the big battle for Civitas here. And it's just really been a big war when it comes to the budget and Roy Cooper's veto. So it'll be interesting to get a little bit closer look at Medicaid expansion and what's going on there. How big are you on Halloween?
I am a huge Halloween person. I would honestly say that is probably my favorite holiday.
Why? Do you think that has something to do with where you grew up, or is it like a family thing? How is it a big thing? Because it wasn't necessarily a big thing for me. It was when I was a kid, but then I was like, when I didn't have to dress up anymore, I kind of like let go.
Okay, yeah. So I guess for me, it's probably just the dressing up. It's still to this day. I held a costume party last year, which this year we're going to be in Colorado Springs for a conference. But last year, dressed up and have done that even since I've been an adult. And I actually have a funny story. A couple years ago, I dressed up like a lumberjack and also dressed my dog up like a lumberjack. So we were matching in that regard. And I decided I was going to have some freckles because lumberjacks have freckles on their face.
Sure. Scandinavian.
Got a little heavy handed, but I was like, it's okay. It's Halloween. It's fine. Had these huge freckles on my face. Went in and was having a meeting with one of my colleagues, and our department head walks into the meeting. When he sees me with the freckles on my face, he goes, oh, like kind of gets a scare. I think about that every time I think about that costume. That was kind of a Halloween costume gone wrong.
Do you know what your first costume was? Or your parents told you if you were too young to remember?
Yeah, I think maybe it was either Minnie Mouse or it was like a Barney character. And I had a younger brother, so we oftentimes did like matching costumes.
Gotcha.
Like I'd be Minnie, he'd be Mickey or something like that.
I was Sherlock Holmes for the very first costume. And then I was like Snoopy for like 2 or 3 years in a row because I was really into Snoopy. And I think my mom is really into Snoopy. So that probably weighed the decision over there. My last Halloween, I was an Islamic terrorist, but that was like in the early 1990s. It wasn't a politically correct thing to do.
You would not be able to do that
today. No, I don't think you'd get away with that today. So
you're saying your kids are going to have matching costumes this year?
Plus, that last time I was an Islamic terrorist, I felt bad because I terrorized and scared like some of the little kids and stuff. So I repent and I'm sorry for that, because I just remember, like I had some shaving cream in my trick or treat bag. And I remember spraying this kid. He was such a sweet kid, but I thought I was just like, I wasn't tormenting him, but you know, when you're bigger and stuff. And I just remember his mom being upset because he actually didn't get the trick or treat. He had to go home and mom had to give him a bath and stuff. I felt so bad.
Yeah, you better.
I ruined that kid's Halloween. So if you're out there, I'm sorry. I feel bad about that.
I hope you shared your candy with him that year.
No, I don't think I did. I mean, I don't know if I felt that bad at that time. Maybe I think, honestly, if I remember it, I think I remember wanting to give him my candy, but also didn't want to like walk to his house and face sort of the indictment, you know, that maybe would come from him or his parents, more likely his parents because he was small.
Right.
But anyways, yeah. So I don't know. I've never been a huge Halloween person. I remember up in Grand Rapids, I bought candy and kids never came one time. So that was a little bit of a letdown. But I've always thought like Halloween was a little bit more for kids. So I've never been like into the Halloween parties so much and stuff. But
I think that's fair. It is different as an adult. That year that I was a lumberjack, we had a lot of kids. We were in a neighborhood up in Kentucky. And then last year, I'm in a townhome here in Raleigh, and we didn't have any children come by. So I think it just depends on your neighborhood, probably.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm just going to look, because I'm very interested in just freedom and, you know, what's going on around the globe in terms of human rights and freedom. And I feel like we're losing a little bit of that today, partly because a lot of people, you know, I grew up in the tail end of the Cold War, but we're seeing, I think, people not being able to defend freedom or really articulate what it means, not necessarily our view of constitutional freedom, but just human rights in general. And I saw some of you that are on Twitter have seen this. You may not. You've seen on some other social media platforms, but Rockets general manager Daryl Morey made statements in support of protesters in Hong Kong last week. He was actually forced to apologize. NBA basketball is a big deal in China. And Jim Garrity wrote a good piece in National Review explaining how we aren't actually exporting our values to China, but importing those their values of censorship here. And here's an interesting thing. This is what's kind of going on. You've had some people go to NBA games, the preseason games, and are holding up signs in support of Hong Kong. You've probably seen it on social media. They're getting them ripped down, taken away. You know, technically, there's like a no political sign policy in these stadiums, but if they're just saying free Hong Kong, I mean, you can make an argument how political that is. I mean, certainly, I guess, somewhat political, but you know, it's just kind of bizarre to see that in America, where we're not even supporting human rights in China or democracy, because we used to export all of those values for a long, long time. But I also saw Chris Taylor tweet this interesting things, the way corporations are apologizing or curtailing to, or basically molding themselves to China's censorship. I mean, here's just a few examples he put out. Apple has handed over iCloud data encryption keys to China. They don't do this for other nations. Activision Blizzard cut live stream when American university team held up pro Hong Kong signs. Gap apologized to China for selling T-shirts in Canada that didn't include Taiwan as a part of China. Ray-Ban changed its website description of Taiwan and Hong Kong to China Taiwan and China Hong Kong. Of course, there's anybody who knows anything about world history knows that there's a big sort of who has ownership and access over Taiwan. Taiwan's traditionally been free, but of course, the British, when they pulled out of Taiwan, it created some angst for some of their future survivability under freedom. And China, of course, makes promises and then reneges on those promises. But here's another example. Apple censors Taiwan flag emoji in iOS in Hong Kong. So you just got a lot of censorship by media corporations and conglomerate corporations in America of anything that's pro-Hong Kong. So it's just interesting to see for me to see, Lee. I don't know if you have any kind of responses or things that you've seen on this, but it's just kind of sad, because we used to, and Trump, I think, deserves some condemnation for this too, because he tweeted out this statement, you know, congratulating China for their years of existence, even though Chairman Mao killed like 60 or 70 million people when there was the communist takeover of China. So, you know, it's just kind of sad to see some of this where we're just kowtowing to China so much.
Yeah, I think it is very scary considering China's power on the world stage, and that's only increasing. And I think you're seeing those companies are worried about what companies are worried about, right? Their bottom line. Mm-hmm. But because of China's buying power. Yeah, it is interesting, like you said, to see those values coming into also their dealings in America, with those being American countries, China being able to manipulate them somewhat through market forces, but through putting pressure on them potentially for like censorship type reasons.
Yeah, exactly. And it is disappointing. I mean, I'm a kid of a Cold War. My dad flew airplanes in the Air Force, and I remember him sitting alert in an underground bunker to be ready for a nuclear war. And it was a different time, and the things were a little bit more black and white. And, you know, we had presidents that spoke out strongly on human freedom. I mean, of course, Reagan was great at this. Ronald Reagan did a good job always of just kind of making the moral argument about human freedom and why that was so important, and why the West, in their view of human freedom, was superior to sort of these totalitarian regimes and communist dictatorships around the world. So it's just kind of sad to me, at least, to see. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but, you know, it's just sad to see, I think, this kind of misguided speech, basically for the bottom line, in censorship. I mean, it's one thing if they're going to just say, you know, we're not going to take a position on that because we have so much money invested over there and we have a lot of dollars coming back to us. But they're actually going forward and censoring some of these statements that people are making, or censoring any sort of positive views towards freedom in Hong Kong, is troubling to me. So let's switch over to North Carolina. I saw a recent editorial, or not editorial, it was a News and Observer story about Medicaid expansion, Leah, and it was about Senator Don Davis's letter. I don't know if you can fill us in a little bit on that. What's kind of going on with the latest on Medicaid expansion in North Carolina?
Yeah. So, as you said earlier, Medicaid expansion has really tied up a lot of other things in North Carolina, namely the budget. So Governor Roy Cooper has been having a Medicaid or nothing ultimatum on whether or not he's going to agree to a budget, whether that be the original budget or a compromise. He's kind of saying Medicaid or nothing. And a lot of Republicans and conservatives have been expressing concerns throughout this whole legislative session that thus far have not really been addressed by the governor. He kind of keeps repeating the same rhetoric over and over without really addressing the legitimate criticisms. And so now you have a Democrat auditor, Beth Wood, who was on a radio program and essentially said, are we just going to dump more people into a broken system? Our Medicaid program is broken. How are we going to expand it? And Senator Don Davis, who is also a Democrat, sent in a letter to the auditor and said, secretary of Health and Human Services to say, hey, I heard the auditor say this. What's your response? Do you think this is true? And you have Mandy Cohen, who is a Governor Cooper appointee. She's been leading the charge on Medicaid expansion in the state. You have her saying, no, that's outdated. You know, we're fine. We're improving and we should expand. And then you have some legitimate concerns from Don Davis. But another interesting thing I thought that was in Colin Campbell's piece in the News and Observer was that also in that same radio program, the auditor said, we have three more audits coming out in the next 90 days, and they're going to show where people are breaking rules and breaking the law and not even caring about it. And that was essentially her words. And so I think it would be a shame in the next 90 days to see, it's blatantly breaking state policy, state rules, and thinking nothing of it. Those were her words. So if we expand Medicaid and then 90 days later find out it was a huge mistake, we are not going to be able to go back on that. That's going to be a very bad situation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this. I know you've written about this. I've written about this. But I think one of the big disasters of Medicaid expansion is it doesn't really deal with the, you know, absolute problem that we have with healthcare, which is one of cost, right? I mean, it just sort of kicks it over to the federal government to carry most of the bulwark of the cost, but it doesn't deal with the fundamental problem that we have in this state and nation, which is the rising cost of healthcare. And there are many reasons for that. Some of them health related, some of them lifestyle, some of them just a rise of chronic illnesses. There's many reasons for that. But I think, you know, what I would like to see is a greater commitment, I think, to addressing one of costs. And I think that there's some things that we can do. And I know you've written about this, Leah. I mean, what are just a few examples? Because I think this is kind of like the, you know, dinner table issue out there for a lot of people in conversation. Healthcare costs continue to skyrocket. So what are some ways to kind of address costs? I mean, as a policy expert, what do you look at? I know you do a lot more stuff than just healthcare, but what do you look at when you're kind of dealing with costs in healthcare, and what are some ways that we could solve that?
Yeah, I think you're right that this does affect a lot of North Carolinians. And the thing about Medicaid expansion is we're talking about very, very low income people. So we're not talking about middle income families. We're not even talking about low-ish income. We're talking about just really the bottom 138% of federal poverty. And that's not most North Carolinians. And right. So everyone else is still bearing these burdens of high costs. And I actually read a really excellent piece. It was an op-ed written by a surgeon I read this week. And he was kind of saying the number one thing he would do to increase healthcare affordability in the United States is price transparency. Mm-hmm. And he used the example of, we don't book an airplane flight. And when we book it, we can see how much it costs. But what if we got on the site instead and it said, we can't possibly tell you what it's going to cost because we don't know if you're going to have a travel delay, right, a weather delay, if you're going to have a drink on the plane, what's going to happen. So we can't tell you the cost. That's not how that works. Mm. But essentially, that is how healthcare works in our country right now, with the providers and the insurance companies negotiating behind closed doors for what they're going to get. And then ultimately, the patient ends up being the loser with those high, unpredictable costs.
Yeah. I mean, I could just give a little example. I had a minor outpatient procedure. It ended up being covered by my health company, but it wasn't at first because there seemed to be some ambiguity about who's in network and out of network and those things. But the doctor was in network, but the anesthesiologist may not have been. So that can, you know, and people don't realize that going in. They don't think to check, oh, well, the doctor's in network, the facility's in network, but here comes this anesthesiologist and maybe he's just in the room for a few minutes and he gives you maybe a slight prep before you go in for the procedure, but you could be hit with thousands of dollars. In some cases, if you have more of a major surgery, they say you're having open heart surgery, you know, that could be tens and tens of thousands of dollars. And that's why, you know, medical debt and medical bankruptcies weren't really the fastest growing sort of negative consequences of a lot of people's finances today.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And one thing that's important to note is this kind of third payer system where people are out of touch with their prices because the insurance handles it, but then the insurance is mishandling it in a lot of cases, or things are happening behind closed doors. In the op-ed that I read from the surgeon, he referenced a study where a research group called different hospitals across the country to ask them, what is the cost of this procedure? It's a heart surgery. It's a basic procedure. What is the cost? And they had a huge range from around, I believe it was maybe 44,000 was the high, and like, or maybe it was 400,000 was the high. I have to get the op-ed, but it was just a giant spread of what this could cost depending on the location. And then they ran a test. Are the higher cost places better quality? And the answer was no.
Yeah.
And so you have that disconnect between price and quality, whereas in a free market with competition, you see prices go down and quality increase. And we're not seeing that in healthcare in North Carolina or the nation.
Right? Yeah, I think that's a great proposal. I know it was something that Donald Trump talked about a lot, was actually price transparency. He hasn't talked about it as much because he's got a lot of other things going on. But that would be something I would like to see. And I know there's doctors in the Midwest especially. I've seen more of them, and not so much North Carolina. But I have heard, and it may just be because I'm not reading stories in North Carolina about this, but I've seen several facilities in the Midwest, especially in states like Kansas and Iowa. They're actually putting up their prices on the website. And I know that there are other doctors that do this. I don't know as much about North Carolina just because I haven't seen it here. Someone probably out there listening is saying, you know, yelling, oh, I know this doctor does that. They list out their prices in a visible way to see. You can always ask and get prices, but some places put it on their website, or they put it, you know, make it visible for the patient to see. And I think that's a very positive thing. Certainly if you're paying a significant cost out of pocket, or you have a very high deductible plan, that makes a lot of sense just to begin with for your own personal finances. So I think that's a great place to start. I think it would definitely create more competition, open the market. You know, that's the thing that happens with, I'm interested in investing, and a lot of these companies are, you know, they put up their prices about, you know, what does it cost to trade here or to invest? And then it's created this huge investing trade, basically war, a price war between all these different organizations. They want to be the lowest price because it's so easy to move your money around in most cases and compete for the dollars. So it's interesting to see how the free market operates that way. And it would be good to see more of that in the healthcare. And I know that the free market, this is probably, you know, this might be a heresy to some, but I don't think the free market can necessarily solve every single problem when it comes to healthcare, but it can solve a lot of problems. And I think because we have such a system now that's you know, chronically relying more and more on government and pushing, you know, ultimately, I think one of the things with the Obamacare legislation was they wanted to create a single payer plan and get more government involved. Inevitably, it fails, and then it's easier to swoop in and create single payer in this land. So yeah, I think it's time for more free market reforms, Leah.
I think you're completely right about the trajectory and what Medicaid expansion proponents in North Carolina, this is just step one in what they would like to see in the future. But to comment on your suggestion that the free market can't solve everything, I would agree with you on that. And I think that's why it's so important that we fix the current Medicaid system, because currently Medicaid provides for the most needy among us. So low-income children, low-income pregnant women, but also low-income individuals with disabilities. And that's something none of us know. You know, our children could have a severe disability, or someone that we know and love. And there's no way to prepare for that if it's something that's going to cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And in fact, in North Carolina, we have supplemental program, so those individuals can get traditional Medicaid, and then they can also apply for an innovations waiver, which is additional funding to help them get care if they need in their homes, assistance with bathing or feeding themselves. And right now in North Carolina, we have 12,000 severely disabled individuals on a waiting list for those services. And so we're talking about expanding Medicaid coverage to able-bodied working age adults, but we're not even providing for these individuals that really have the most needs. And that is sort of where the free market, you could say, fails to some degree. And there is a case to be made for government intervention with us helping those that are truly the most needy among us. But Medicaid expansion is not that.
That's a great point, Leah. And I think that that's kind of the distinction that a lot of people miss is they think, oh, well, we can just help more and more people. But it crowds out people that really do need help, and especially with, you know, a lot of times the sustainability because the government's paying more on the able-bodied adults. Working able-bodied adults, then, you know, it creates a burden on the system. And I think that's kind of what Don Davis was getting to a little bit, is how sustainable is the system? And particularly, and you know, you and I have written a lot about this, but when we're almost $23 trillion in debt, how much more the government's going to continue to pick up the tab at the rate it does? There's going to be systematic changes at some point, and, you know, you don't want to be a state left holding the bag on this. So we're going to transition to our kind of final thing. Talk a little bit about the election in 2020. I don't know if you have any thoughts, Leah. You know, it's usually Brooke and I giving thoughts on 2020, so it'd be good to get another perspective in here. A lot of the betting sites still have Trump as not necessarily the top person of the available candidates. There's a couple of betting sites that say the Democrats are going to win the White House, but when you actually list the people out, Trump still is number one. You know, if it's just sort of generic Democrat, he is behind. But if you actually list them out name by name, then in some of these betting sites, he comes out above. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about, you can go to North Carolina too, not just nationally.
Yeah, I think nationally, that's super interesting that he's behind a generic Democrat. It's not at all surprising. I think if the Democrats had had a great candidate, they could have beat Donald Trump. But I think anyone they're putting up now doesn't seem to be someone that could beat him, in my opinion. Especially a lot of people I knew that voted for Donald Trump maybe weren't the biggest fan of him as a person, and they were kind of skeptical about his policy positions. But a lot of people I know voted for him because of the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And his time in office, he's done a great job with that. And then also on his policy front, he has not been bad. He's been good in a lot of ways.
He's been more conservative than I thought he would ever be.
Yes, me too. And so I think a lot of people that kind of held their nose and voted for him last time are going to feel more confident, especially when you have the media saying, oh, Trump is president, the world is going to fall apart. And then when that doesn't happen, it's kind of, you know, people realize the sky isn't falling, the economy's doing well. And I think Trump has a decently easy path to victory in from my perspective.
And one of the things interesting, I know Trump has gone to Minnesota a few times recently. He wants to turn that state red. It almost flipped in 1984 when Ronald Reagan almost beat Walter Mondale in every state except Minnesota, which was his home state, I believe. And some people that ran the campaign in Minnesota, they were just volunteers, thought that Reagan had actually won, but there was a little bit of shenanigans going on. But anyway, that aside, the last person to officially win Minnesota in a presidential election that was Republican was Richard Nixon in 1972. So that would be a tremendous flip if Trump could figure out a way to win Minnesota in 2020. So what about North Carolina, just real briefly? Any thoughts, anything that surprises you out there in terms of, you know, maybe people running for on the state ballot?
Yeah.
Is there anything out there that kind of surprises you or you're looking forward to seeing?
I am looking forward to the governor's race. I think that's going to be really interesting. Incumbent Governor Roy Cooper is going to be up against the current Lieutenant Governor, Dan Forrest, presumably. Now, Dan Forrest does have a primary.
Yeah, do you think Holly Grange has any chance to get traction?
Holly Grange doesn't seem to necessarily have the campaign wherewithal that Dan Forrest has, where he really has this kind of grassroots strategy in all 100 counties. I don't think Holly Grange has that kind of name recognition.
You think she's kind of waiting around to see if he slips? So maybe she already has an organization if something happens to Dan Forrest, so she can kind of, you know, worm her way in there?
It could be something like that. And Dan Forrest actually gets a lot of heat from the media on some of his social conservative views.
Oh, yeah, he gets that.
And so I think maybe Holly Grange is kind of presenting herself as more of a libertarian kind of economic conservative instead of the true social conservative that Dan Forrest is. I think maybe she's kind of hedging her bets incorrectly on that when it comes to how North Carolina feels about social issues.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, that should be interesting, especially given if it is a Cooper versus Forrest showdown. It should be interesting given Cooper's ability so far to come across as a moderate and his ability to stay away from controversial issues for the most part, or the reluctancy of the media to ask him hard questions, I think contributes to that. But he's been able to really come across as a moderate, and I think Dan Forrest has his conservative image too. It's an asset for him, but he also has to overcome it with certain populations.
Sure. I think that's probably true. It'll be interesting to see, because you know all the Republicans in North Carolina have had to, for lack of a better word, I don't mean this in a degrading way, but suck up to Donald Trump, right, to win. I mean, they cast their lot with Donald Trump. Trump comes down here and kind of, you know, plays kingmaker a little bit and builds them up. And it'll be interesting to see if, you know, because I expect whatever happens, if Trump wins or loses, I expect him to actually win North Carolina pretty easily, especially if the nominee is somebody like Elizabeth Warren, or I don't expect it to be Bernie Sanders anymore, but if it's Elizabeth Warren, I think it'll be almost a cakewalk for Trump to win North Carolina at that point. And doesn't mean she can't win the whole election, but I just don't see her winning North Carolina. And, you know, with that being said, it'll be interesting to see if the coattails of Donald Trump really help pull Forrest along and give him a legitimate shot to unseat, you know, Cooper. But, you know, Forrest, to his credit, had more votes last time than Donald Trump. So, you know, he's a go-getter out there, and he can unearth votes. And he was the top vote getter in 2016 in North Carolina. So, you know, there's no reason why he can't do it again. So any final thoughts, Leah?
No, I'm excited for 2020. I like a good election year, and we also have a U.S. Senate race, so there won't be a dull moment.
It's crazy, and it'll be, you know, we're going to be so tired of it by the time it's just, you know, the candidates are coming, especially when they're actually in Wake County, because the media, you know, is just sort of, you know, in our little pocket and universe, it just kind of explodes, and on social media, it's everywhere. So, Leah, thank you for being here today. We had a lot of fun, so I'm sure you'll hear from her again at some point. And I'd like to thank all of our listeners. Go check our content out at nccivitas.org. And go check our content and join us for CLC. Go look at that. We will have that in April of 2020. So we hope that you, wherever you're listening, come to Raleigh and join us in April for CLC. It's going to be a fun time. Thank you.